If you go to my university website, you'll be able to find that there's about over 60 of my audio recordings of my lectures that I've given in various contexts on various things, so you can find. Now, first of all, let me say it's a real pleasure to be addressing you, people who are going into library and information science. I think this is a very important field, and it's a field that I think historically has failed to realize its importance. So in a sense, you underestimate your significance for the university. And I think one of the ways you can sort of see this in a very obvious way is that a university is supposed to be a place that is concerned with the systematic organization of knowledge, the way it's produced and distributed. That's a very obvious way of thinking about what a university is as an institution. But if you actually look at the different parts of the university, it's really just the people who are in the library and information science side that are literally interested in this topic. Right, and this is where all the great emphases on various kinds of classification systems and so forth are made. And yet that's not given very much credit. And it's very interesting because if you go back to the founding of the modern university, and what I mean by the modern university is the one that's associated with the, maybe this name means nothing to you, but if you are a big defender of the university, it means a lot, and that is Wilhelm von Humboldt. Okay, he was the rector of the University of Berlin in the early 19th century. And he's the guy from whom we get this idea that an academic is someone who integrates teaching and research in what they do. So in other words, so the idea is that research, by definition, means finding out about new things, and then the whole point of teaching is to take that knowledge and distribute it so that others who were not involved in the initial production of the knowledge actually get access to it. Okay, and that's the integration of teaching and research. It is the Humboldtian idea behind the modern university. All universities continue to pay lip service to it. Some, as it were, follow it more strictly than others. Okay. Now, the interesting thing about this, about Humboldt, is in this kind of conception of the university, and I think you got to, it was the idea that all knowledge could be pursued there, both in terms of research and in terms of teaching. So it was a kind of free zone for thought. This was a radically different conception of the university from what had preceded it. Universities, as you may know, are medieval institutions. They go back to the 12th, 13th century, they were places that even in places like Oxford and Cambridge, you had to take holy orders in order to be able to teach there as late as the 19th century. So there was a very sort of strong religious foundation to universities historically. And this meant that the kinds of people who were being trained in universities were elites meant to rule over others, both in a sacred and secular capacity. And the knowledge that was being reproduced in those institutions was just basically for purposes of ruling. But Humboldt basically came up with this idea that no, the university ought to be dynamic, and the only way it can be dynamic is by incorporating into itself all the kinds of knowledge that is available. And then the value added of the university is that it provides some kind of systematic organization of it. Okay? So whereas you might say the original university was a place that kind of made all the decisions for you in terms of what you should know, right? The modern university is one that, as it were, lays out all the possibilities and, as it were, gives you a kind of roadmap, gives you a kind of way to navigate around it. That's kind of a very up-to-date way of talking about what the transition was in the two conceptions of the university that you start to get with Humboldt in the early 19th century. And Humboldt is someone who's very much influenced in his philosophical views by Immanuel Kant. Just out of curiosity, how many of you have heard of Immanuel Kant? Good, excellent. I'm sorry to be patronizing about this, but one always needs to get some kind of cultural baseline. So Immanuel Kant is probably the most influential modern philosopher, okay? And he is someone who Humboldt was very much influenced by. And Kant, a lot of his views about the nature of knowledge were formulated by his watching the way in which the various faculties of the university, and so if you're talking about Kant's time in the late 18th century, university consists of law, medicine, theology primarily. Okay, so in other words, it's professional training, just like I was saying, training for the elites. And Kant was noticing how all of these different disciplines were in fact contesting each other's knowledge claims, and they were all in all kinds of power games with each other. And there was really no way of kind of rationally adjudicating or sorting out who knows what about what. And so he wrote a very interesting essay called The Contest of the Faculties in the at the very end of the 18th century. And it was about saying that we need some systematic understanding of knowledge, right, in order to be able to adjudicate these disputes among these different experts, we would call them today, who are overstating their claims all the time, right, in a power move. We need someone who's able to adjudicate this. And so this is where the modern university comes from. So then the initial people who were teaching in the university, and the idea was that the university would be founded in a sort of general discipline that was called philosophy. Again, I think this is, again, worth pointing out, that prior to this period of the Humboldt University, if you wanted to talk about what was the overarching discipline behind all knowledge, it was theology. And theology was understood in a very authoritarian kind of way, namely as a dogma from which all the other disciplines had to obey. So this eliminated lots of knowledge, in fact, from the institution. But when philosophy became the foundation of the university in the Humboldtian period, then the problem became, how do you organize all the things that are called knowledge? It became an organizational question where there is an assumption that there are jurisdictional disputes all the time, that the people are claiming to know things they don't really know. How do we organize this? And also to give a sense of what do you need to know before you learn something else. So all those kinds of questions, you know, we would call them questions of access today, right? We would call them questions of classification. That was in fact the stuff the philosophers were doing. And those were the people who were the most important. They were sort of the anchor people of the university. They were the people who you first were exposed to before you specialized in any subject. And so the school of philosophy that was most prominent in this vein were the German idealists. And you may know some of these names since you knew who Kant was. You know, I'll just put the names down. We're not having a quiz or anything here. But just to give you a sense, you may know some or all of these names. And one of the characteristic features of all of these German idealist philosophers, Fichte, Schelling, Hegel, is that they are preoccupied with systematizing knowledge, coming up with encyclopedias. Right? I mean, Hegel uses the term very explicitly in one of his works, right? Giving a sense of what is foundational, what builds on what, and providing a kind of overarching intellectual map. And what is the purpose of doing that? Well, it's actually meant to be empowering, right? Because here's a student who comes in there, right, and needs to know what is that, you know, needs to have a kind of general sense of all that there is to know and where to find it and what relates to what. Okay. Now, these guys were not library scientists in the sense that they were concerned about, you know, classifying particular documents or anything. That wasn't their concern, but at a conceptual level, that's what they were doing. They were organizing knowledge at a conceptual level. And this very much resonates, I think, with the kinds of tasks that people in library information science continue to set for themselves, especially if we think about this as a kind of global exercise. And I stress this global exercise business because there's a very live debate in your field, it continues to this day, about the relationship between generalizing and specializing, okay? And it seems to me that in order to have a proper kind of field of library and information science in this way that I've been talking about, you have to hold on to the universal generalizable ideal, right? And why is that important? Well, it's not just because it makes the field appear more important, though it does that. I mean, because if you think, but also because there's really no other field that is concerned with this issue. Because even a field like philosophy, if you know something about the development of philosophy since the early 19th century, right, so I'm trained in history and philosophy of science originally, and one of the things that you notice about this field is that it gets more and more specialized itself over time. So the philosophy itself becomes a kind of technical discipline with its own problems, and in a way kind of steps back from the general questions about how knowledge should be organized. And this is pretty much left to the library and information science people insofar as they want to take up the challenge. Okay? So one of the people who is very important in your field, who intersects with the larger ambitions of philosophy in the 20th century, because the German idealists weren't the last guys to actually be concerned about the organization of knowledge in the sense that we're talking about here. There was this guy in the early 20th century, Paul Otley, Belgian, who, if you don't know who he is, you'll find out probably in some historical course at some point. And he was very closely tied with the logical positivist movement in philosophy. I don't know how many of you have heard of logical positivism. A few have, okay. Well, one of the points of this movement was again, it arises in the 1920s. By the time you get to the 1920s, there's just an enormous number of disciplines and forms of knowledge around, again, with competing authorities, competing expertises, and no clear way of going forward, each with their own technical languages. And so the question becomes, what does this all add up to as knowledge? How do we organize this? You see, Otley is concerned about sort of an explosion in documentation taking place in the early 20th century, but there's also a kind of linguistic and conceptual explosion taking place corresponding to it. How do you organize knowledge at that level? And so Otley was actually in a lot of correspondence with these guys, these logical positivists, because they saw themselves as kindred spirits. And the logical positivists, they called their movement the international, what they were trying to do was the International Encyclopedia of Unified Science. So in other words, laying out all the disciplines, all their foundational concepts, and then showing how they related to each other. Okay? The last volume in that series, which went from the 1930s to the 1960s and is published by University of Chicago Press, was a famous book by Thomas Kuhn, which maybe you've heard of, called The Structure of Scientific Revolutions. That was the last volume of this series. Okay? And the point of having it as the last volume was this was the moment that science reflected upon itself. Right? So Kuhn's book, if you know anything about Kuhn's book, it is a theory of scientific change. How the sciences transform themselves over time. It's been used and understood as a kind of general model for how knowledge, systematic forms of knowledge, transform over time. And so this is the final volume, because there's a sense in which after you know the foundations of all the individual sciences and you know how they relate to each other at a logical level, the thing you also need to know is how they transform themselves over time. How knowledge improves, how knowledge progresses, and so forth. And this book was it's probably the most influential book on the nature of science to have been written in the last 50 years. And may turn out to have been the most influential book of the 20th century in this area. Okay? I've written a book very critical of what this book says, but nevertheless, the point I want to talk about is not why I don't believe what the book says, but nevertheless, the conception of having such a book. The idea that we need some kind of second-order understanding of how science is organized and how science transforms itself over time. And moreover, and this is the important point, and this is where the philosophers and the library and information scientist people are on the same side, is that you don't have to be, and in fact, being a specialist may not necessarily put you in a good position to know this. Right, to know how knowledge is organized is to some extent stand outside of the actual knowledge production activity. That's a very important point about your field. Your field is what we call in philosophy a second order discipline. Okay? So if you imagine the first order disciplines are the normal academic disciplines, where you can, as it were, point to particular subject matter that is theirs and only theirs. Biologists study the nature of life, right? Physics studies the nature of material reality, right? You can point to specific things specific disciplines do. But what the library and information science studies is those disciplines, right? It studies disciplinization, in a sense. And so it's second order. It stands above the actual practice, okay? Because when you study to become a biologist, there are a lot of things that you probably don't study very much about in terms of biology. So, for example, the only research that you probably study in biology is the research that's relevant to the cutting edge of the fields that you happen to be in. In other words, you do not study all the stuff that has been published in biology, not only in the past, but also in the present. And so, for example, what are the things that people in library and information science, the people who are in this field, this branch of your field called bibliometrics, sometimes it's called scientometrics, right? One of the things that's a very recurrent feature of this part of the field is to say that, look, 90% of all the stuff that's actually published in a given discipline either goes unread or uncited. It's there, it's published, it's documented, but nobody's reading it, and nobody's encouraging you to read it. And the reason why people write this stuff that ends up getting documented is largely for credentialing reasons. So in other words, to keep your job in a university, you have to publish a certain amount in certain places, right? And if you've demonstrated that, you get to keep your job or get promoted or something of that kind. But it doesn't follow that a lot of people are reading your stuff. So one of the big mistakes, or one of the big fallacies, you might say, that specialists often have is thinking that what they themselves know of their field is most of or even the totality of their field. No. In fact, what they know is, in fact, a relatively small part of their field, but it is the part that is institutionally most important for the field. But there's all this other stuff out there. And who cares about that? You do. Okay? And this is one of the reasons why, I've been here for close to 48 hours now. I've done all sorts of talks everywhere in 48 hours. But one issue that keeps coming up is this: what is information? Okay? Your dean, in fact, asked me this as his first question. And he's the dean. He should know. And the thing that I would say that's relevant here in terms of the discussion that I've been having with you is that information at the first instance is the stuff from which knowledge is produced, right? And that's why the emphasis on the documents, on the publications, is in a way very important to the library and information scientist, more so than to the practitioner. A practitioner of a field, right? So when a biologist is concerned about the field of biology insofar as it promotes the research that they're trying to do that will get them recognition by their peers. That's their interest in biology. But you're interested in biology as a literal body of knowledge that's produced and published and it needs to be documented, organized, classified, etc. And that means you're actually interested in more of the field than they are. And you probably, if you have really good organizational classification systems, you can probably access more of the knowledge of the field than they can. Okay? And that's the challenge, in fact, you see. So if you want to talk about which field is the keeper of universal knowledge, it's your field. Nobody else. You have no competitors. Okay? And I think one of the problems is that, in a sense, the field hasn't really risen to the challenge in this respect. Okay? There's a lot of interesting issues to pursue here. One thing that I think to underscore, because I think this is going to be true of any of you who plan to be information specialists in any academic discipline. This phenomenon that I'm talking about, where most of the stuff that's actually published is ignored. Okay, you have to think, why is that happening? What is going on here, right? And there are two kinds of aspects to this that have to do with the way in which academic knowledge is institutionalized today. And it's, I think, something that you always have to keep in mind. There is a kind of systematic collective forgetting that takes place within academic disciplines of the very knowledge they produce. Okay, relatively little of it is actually carried forward from generation to generation. It is the stuff that's typically enshrined in the textbooks, right? And the point of having those textbooks when you do, especially at the introductory level in academic disciplines, is those textbooks are designed to kind of get you thinking a certain way about what's relevant in that field. And what they will then highlight are certain kinds of exemplary cases from the history of the field that should be the models on the basis of which you do your research. Now, to be able to have that kind of streamlined presentation, which lends itself easily to setting up, problems that you can do, and then the teacher can see whether you're competent or not, and all that kind of stuff, is you've got to ignore a lot of things. You've got to act as if most of the field doesn't exist. You have to just focus on these particular examples. And Thomas Kuhn's book, which I mentioned earlier, is actually excellent on this point. So Kuhn is known for the coinage of this word paradigm. Right? What I've just described to you as how a discipline reproduces itself by streamlining its examples and ignoring most of everything else that's happening, that is the paradigm. Okay? That is how you learn the paradigm. Right? So if you're a physicist, you approach a problem a certain way. So until the rise of Einstein, you always approach a problem as if it were something out of Newtonian mechanics, no matter what the subject matter was. And people who had alternative ways of pursuing physics just didn't get a look in. They just ignored. They published many books, etc., etc., but they didn't get a look in. They're completely marginalized. But the stuff still exists. Moreover, the stuff also has influence in other areas. I mean, that's the other thing, too. I mean, Kuhn has a very interesting concept, which, in a way, people in this field really haven't picked up. It's one of his more interesting ones. It's called Kuhn loss. At least that's how it's dubbed. Kuhn loss is the idea, as you know, if you know anything about Kuhn's view of science is it goes through these revolutions, as the title of the book indicates. And what that means is, a revolution is when a science radically shifts its framework, the framework in which it's operating. So that what ends up happening is, stuff that was seen as very central and vital to the conduct of the science in the earlier paradigm, drop out. And you get this new focus. And this is not to say you just completely junk the past, but rather the relative significance of various episodes from the history of science look different. Okay? So for example, in the period of Newton, so Newtonian mechanics, right, was the first physical theory to unify the motions of the heavens and the earth. Very impressive. It lasts 200 years, roughly speaking. By 1905, Einstein has already published his papers, and then you get a paradigm shift in another 15 years or so, and you end up having more or less the kind of view of physics that we have today. One of the consequences of that shift is that one of the things that Newton believed very much in, the idea of there being an ether through which matter was moving in the universe, some kind of physical medium through which all of matter would move, dropped out of the equation. That was no longer part of the new physics. That was just dispensed with. And instead you start getting different sorts of concepts that Newton didn't have, like the idea of curved space, for example. Okay? So you get these kinds of shifts taking place. And what happens then is certain kinds of questions can no longer be asked. And so entire bodies of knowledge can just drop out of sight because the scientists are no longer accessing the kinds of concepts that would be necessary to bring back that kind of knowledge. And that's what's called Kuhn loss. Now, the interesting point is that this knowledge doesn't necessarily disappear. It's still there. And sometimes it actually has influence in other fields. But there's very little incentive to actually track it. Now, the other thing that also is part of this Kuhn loss is that very often knowledge that wasn't, let's say knowledge that ends up getting dropped, ends up in a way coming back to haunt the paradigm in the future. Okay? So, for example, one of the things, in the foundations of the social sciences, there was a whole lot of discussion about the seriousness with which one should take the fact that cultures are different. Can there be universal laws of humanity and so forth? And certain disciplines, of course, went full speed ahead and tried to come up with universal laws of humanity and society and so forth. So economics, for example, psychology to a certain extent, even sociology has participated in these kinds of projects. Nevertheless, even though the diversity of humanity got sort of systematically excluded in the foundations of those disciplines, nevertheless, the problem didn't go away. We still have it with us today, and it causes enormous amounts of problems. In some cases, even leads to the establishment of new disciplines. And one of the things that happens when those new disciplines get established is that people start reading all of that old stuff that had gotten forgotten. They start to realize, yes, we didn't invent these problems now. These problems were there a long time ago, but people ignored them. People managed to marginalize them because of the relative power of the players who were involved in the knowledge business back then. Now you see, you guys can be on top of all that stuff. This kind of the way in which forms of knowledge get advanced, get marginalized, but it doesn't go away. The stuff doesn't go away. And this is where the fact that you people are interested in documentation becomes very important. You're interested in texts. You're interested in the matter of knowledge. So even if people aren't taught, you know, even if the concepts aren't prominent in the research agenda, the stuff is still there in the library to find out about. You see, and so in that respect, you have a greater command over the totality of the body of knowledge that's out there than the specialists themselves do. Okay, and so you can actually, you know, I very often see the library and information scientists as you know, operating in a very kind of progressive capacity, namely as providing resources for critique of taken for granted dominant views within specific academic disciplines. Because you actually know that there's other stuff out there that could be consulted that would provide an alternative, if not an oppositional point of view. But see, all of this kind of capacity that you potentially have does depend on having some sense of how knowledge is organized, how to classify it, how to systematize it, and in ways that are not completely parasitic in the disciplines that you're studying. You need your own classification systems that actually cover more broadly and look at the totality of all the documents available and aren't just focused on what the specialists themselves think they need. So you can't be completely user-driven. You can't be completely client-driven. And that's been one of the big problems of this field, is you guys are captive to your clients. And what that does is it ends up warping kind of the intellectual development in the field, because your intellectual existence ends up getting justified purely in terms of what other people think about you. It's as if the field has no autonomy, no intellectual direction of its own. This is why I've been telling you this historical story, because there's a sense in which there is a dire need for a discipline that is concerned with the organization of how knowledge is produced and distributed as a whole. No other discipline does that. You're in the best position to do it. Okay? And the point is, though, unless you decide to do it, no one's going to encourage you to do it, because you have all these other skills that are very useful to people. You can help them search for stuff they already want. That's a very convenient way to go. It's the path of least resistance. All you need to do is master a few bits of technology and boom, you've got a job. Okay? But that does not make for an intellectually coherent discipline. And I think this is the problem that this discipline faces. And since the weakness of the discipline is demonstrated by its client captivity. Okay? And this is true, by the way, of academic disciplines generally. You know, so for example, in the field of biology, you know, when Monsanto attempted to buy out the whole, you know, biology department at Berkeley, University of California, Berkeley, right? I mean, there was a real struggle there, and one of the things that it showed was the extent to which academic disciplines are getting very vulnerable, that they can't turn the money down. And then what happens is the research agenda gets oriented toward where the money comes from. And so this has been a long-standing problem in this field, but it's also affecting other academic fields nowadays. And see, what's at stake here is the integrity of the university as an institution. Because if the university is supposed to aspire to the sort of Humboldtian idea, you know, all knowledge for all people, produced by research, distributed by teaching, right, then there has to be some kind of space where all of knowledge can be organized and considered, and not just the knowledge that happens to be useful for particular people at particular times. Okay, the idea of there being a collective intellectual legacy of humanity, that is the thing that this field in a way aspires to. Now, it was mentioned in the introduction that I'm going to be going to Baltimore to the ACIST meeting, which is the main professional meeting of this discipline. What we're going to be talking about there is very relevant to this point. There was a book that's a collection of papers, essentially, that came out in 1983 called The Study of Information. And the editors, you should look it up in the library, I'm sure it's here. It's an enormous book. Maclip and Mansfield, economists. And the whole point of this book, which is a landmark book, and we're basically going to be revisiting the main thesis of the book 30 years later. The point of this book was, so we're talking 1983, we're sort of at the advent of the computer age, right? And the whole idea that information transactions will be computer mediated is something that in 1983 is a very obvious future. And so the proposition that was put forward in this book was library information science will finally be able to achieve this kind of global ambition of being able to organize and systematize all knowledge in a way in which other theorists in this field tried to do but could not do in the past because the technology was not available. So if you look at somebody like Paul Otley, who I mentioned earlier, this guy is just he's like one big library catalog, you know, the kind of old-style card catalog thing. He just spent his whole life producing a massive library card catalog, okay? Now, what a nightmare, okay? And so the idea was that kind of, the labor intensiveness of that kind of activity, which is basically how a lot of, you know, organizational systems in this field got established, could be minimized. The labor intensity of it could be minimized with sort of computerized organization. That was the great hope. And so now the library information science person would be in the position of thinking about, okay, what are the concepts, what are the categories that we should be using to organize the knowledge? Because the kind of labor-intensive aspect of it, you know, making the little cards and the catalogs, right, we won't need to do that anymore. We could spend our time thinking about it, and also reflecting on the fact that it is the period where knowledge is exploding in terms of the, you know, more science is being done, computers will allow us to do more stuff. All of this was being realized in 1983, okay? Very clear. And this then produces a task for the library and information scientists, a conceptual task of how do you organize knowledge under those circumstances, and that this field is the field that is best positioned to do it. And so some of the leading theorists of the field at the time wrote articles in favor of this. Fritz Machlup, the principal editor, was an economist who endorsed this field very strongly. You had people from psychology, other fields, very much on top of this and very in favor of it. It didn't happen. It didn't happen. Otherwise you wouldn't be doing the kinds of stuff you're doing now. It wouldn't be so user-driven. It wouldn't be so much a service provider field. See, the idea of the computer was to actually release, you know, the library and information scientist from a certain amount of labor so they could then think about the large questions that motivates the field. But it didn't happen, okay? And there are a lot of reasons why it didn't happen, and this is part of what we will be discussing in Baltimore at the ACES meeting. But the point is, it's not too late, okay? It's not too late, because it, I think we, here's one context where I think this kind of issue makes a big difference.
If you want to, in your field, there's a phrase that's been coined by one of the major library scientists, Donald Swanson, undiscovered public knowledge. That's all the stuff that I was talking about. The stuff that's out there published in the academic literature, which people don't read, and because they don't read it, they don't make the connections between it that could actually solve some serious intellectual problems. And so Swanson is a guy originally trained in physics, moved from physics into library and information science at the University of Chicago. In the 1980s, he published some important articles related to this concept, undiscovered public knowledge, where he basically came up with what turned out to be a correct hypothesis of how to treat some kind of rare medical disorder by reading across literatures, putting together things where people weren't reading the stuff because neither of the pieces were in the research frontier of the mainstream practitioners. So he looked at stuff that was being ignored, put it together, and actually came up with a plausible hypothesis to cure this disease. And this is a guy without training in medicine, but knows how to read, right? Has training in physics. So the point is, you know, he's not a specialist in that strict sense, but he was able to do that. Now the thing is, why don't we have incentive structures that actually encourage people to do this? I mean, and there's one very practical context. I mean, if you look at research budgets, right, when people have to put together research proposals, right, they have to say that the research that they're about to do is original. No one's done it before. People have not solved this problem yet. We need money to do new experiments, to conduct new field studies, whatever, okay? But is that true? It has not. You know, is it true that no one has actually worked on the problem that you want to work on, that no one has actually provided a solution? What is the test by which we make judgments of that kind, okay? Now, you're a grant funding agency. Well, the answer is pretty straightforward. Namely, the person in your field who is judging your application makes an intuitive judgment, or, you know, makes you just say, you're right, I'm thinking of it. No one's ever asked this question. I can't remember anything I've read that's asked this question before. Wow, this is an interesting experiment. Let's support it. It's at that level. It's at that level the judgment is made to commit thousands or millions of dollars to research, okay? In other words, and I believe this is true, I personally believe this is true, is there's a lot of reinvention of the wheel going on a regular basis, largely because the experts in the field do not know everything that's out there in their own fields. The only things they really know about are the things that are quite prominent. But they don't know the more obscure stuff, and the more obscure stuff may, in fact, provide the basis for solving the questions being put forward by these supposedly novel grant proposals. Because you see, in academic disciplines, we actually don't encourage people to read very much. Reading is always kind of a defensive activity, right? You read something in order to criticize it, you read something in order to provide basis for your own claims, but there is no general encouragement to read, generally. So stuff that doesn't fit into what people are being are concerned about at the moment just get ignored. But that doesn't mean it's not there. That's why it's undiscovered public knowledge. Now you see, if every major scientific grant proposal had to have a library and information science kind of certification or some person on there say, well, you know, we have done a literature search of all the stuff, all the concepts, all the areas that are relevant to what is supposedly this novel research proposal, and we come up with the conclusion that no, in fact, this is new, or no, or you know, yes, this is not new, that would be a very significant thing. It could save a lot of money. It would provide greater utilization of the already existing literature. It would maximize all the virtues that this field has to offer to the larger academic community. Okay, but this field isn't taken seriously enough for that to happen. Right, because what I am suggesting is that library information science needs to be right there in the formulation of the grant proposals, right there in the evaluation of the grant proposals, regardless of the field. That's a very big role. Okay? You know, but the field doesn't have any presence in that regard. Okay? So there's a real challenge, there's a real potential for this field, intellectually, that it really hasn't, you know, rallied to yet. And it's one that I think would be a real service to the academic community as a whole. Now, I realize there's a lot of issues about the way this field is positioned with regard to clients, with regard to the university, and maybe these issues might come up in discussion here, right? You know, how do you see yourself as a knowledge producer amidst all these other aspects of, you know, what's happening in the world? But it seems to me that there's a real strong potential here that is just not being fully realized, but goes very much to the heart of what this field is supposed to be about. So what I'll do is I'll open it up to questions here, because I think there's been a lot put on the table, and maybe I'll take some comments, questions from people here. Yeah. Yes, sir.
Last week we had a guest speaker, Mike Ridley, from the University of Guelph. And one of the things he said that seemed interesting to me, and maybe you can comment on it, is that he thinks his academic librarians should locate themselves physically outside the library of the university and leave the running of the day-to-day of the library to other people.
You mean as a kind of mechanical activity?
Yeah. Or I'm not sure.
Is the spirit of the proposal to separate out the conceptual from the administrative part of librarianship?
I think so,
yeah. Yeah, well, I would agree with that. Yes. Yes, the problem is at the moment so much is, it's almost, I actually think that if librarians lean so heavily on the administrative side of the library, then they're going to be replaced. Right, because they're going to be, machines can do this kind of stuff eventually. They can't do it right this minute. They'll do it soon. And so that's just setting yourself up for a disaster. You have to reassert the conceptual foundations of the field and say that no other field has it. That's the only way to survive as a self-respecting academic discipline. Yes, sir?
Yeah, I think it's really interesting how, to position yourself, to give ourselves a position of, you know, kind of meaning within the university and other academic institutions. I just keep thinking, like, how amazing would it be if every faculty had one information professional that worked with them?
Yes.
Those positions don't exist necessarily in many places, right? Like, you know, faculty education doesn't have information professionals waiting for, you know, faculty to submit information or, you know, look up information for them. So how do we kind of get that club to the point where we could be players on the same playing field as faculty?
Well, I think one of the things is you need, you know, this, if you look up Swanson, I'll put his name up there, you should look it up. I'm sure this is the kind of, he's one of the great, great men of this field. There's just not enough examples of this on the table. Let's put it that way, right? So there's this one example that kind of makes a sort of conceptual point about there being all this knowledge out there that nobody reads, but if it were read the right way, you could actually solve a lot of problems without having to do, you know, too much original research, because the stuff's already there, just nobody's reading it, okay? You need more and more examples of that kind of thing. I mean, I've been very struck. There hasn't been many people who really follow up this stuff. It makes a kind of conceptual point, but just leaves it there. But I think you need this for a lot of fields. Right, where you could say, well, look, you guys don't read your own stuff, and there are, in fact, very important things. One thing you could do, I mean, I suppose somebody who's got the time and wants to be a little bit provocative, is to actually look at grant proposals that are accepted by a major funding agency, let's say a state funding agency, and actually do a kind of a search, questioning whether, what, no one's ever done this before? You know, and then basically write an article saying, look how much money could have been saved if people just had some smart way of accessing all the knowledge is already there. You see, because then you could, that would something that certainly would impress a funder.
Right.
and would really put the academics in the back foot, because most funders treat the academic specialists as the people who actually know what their own fields are about. But this is a complete fallacy. All they know about is the research frontier of their own field, and the research frontier is a very small part of the whole field. Yeah?
This has a lot to do with academic librarianship, mm-hmm. but a lot of us are interested in public as well. So what do you think kind of the future for public librarianship is if we were supposed to move towards this? And like, how would that change the structure of our school, really, and how we learn? Because academic librarians maybe would take another pathway, maybe in public.
Well, look, the thing about public libraries is, you know, it's interesting because we go back to Humboldt. There was a question to be asked in the early 19th century, which would also be asked about libraries, is what's the point of having them, right? And when you say the public, right, so the university is public too, what is this public that we are trying in some way to provide knowledge for? Right, so there's a sense in which the first issue, and Humboldt had a very clear answer to this, in the sense that he was talking about the reason why you need an organized sense of knowledge in the academy is because you want to provide a kind of a way for people to explore all the possibilities available to them as free citizens. Right, so it's citizen empowerment. That was the idea of the university. I think a similar idea applies to the public library. Obviously, the organizational structure isn't going to be the same. I think there's some very interesting issues as how do you organize knowledge for that kind of public empowerment, because it doesn't necessarily have to be mapping on from the academic side at all. I don't believe that. I mean, I think it's a sort of different issue. But it is about a certain sense of what citizen empowerment is, right? Organizing knowledge with that kind of thing in mind. Not simply entertainment value, right? But empowerment, where they're allowed to explore, to, you know, to be able to develop themselves in the full way possible. And I think that's kind of, you have to have that kind of idea. And that's something above and beyond, again, you know, people who want to go to the library to satisfy a particular interest, right? There is this kind of larger issue of the empowered citizen. So you really do, I mean, one of the important things about having a universal classification system is, at least in principle, invite someone to kind of browse around and move around from space to space in a sort of commonly mapped domain, right? And that's very, and so the thing is, okay, I'm trying to reach out to this empowered citizen who maybe might be interested in one kind of thing, but if they understand the whole picture, they may be moving around the space a little bit more. You see, that's kind of the way I would approach the problem. And I think that is kind of what, in the context of how public libraries got established in the 19th century as part of democratic education, right, where you're talking about a populace which still, most of whom did not go to university, right, I think that would be, you know, that's the way I would start. So you start with that as a clear idea. Again, I think it's a problem where if you don't have a clear idea of what the institution is about in the first place, then it's not clear how you should be organizing stuff, and you then just become captive clients.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes?
So while we've been listening to your lecture, I think we've all heard you use the words library and information science, library work, and information professional, interchangeably. We've had a couple of readings where Corbin has kind of broadly gone on about how librarians should be attempting to separate themselves by calling themselves professionals, but rather should be calling themselves librarians and acknowledging that they do important, basically that they do important work. And I was curious, in light of your comments about how librarians should be moving outside the physical library to embed themselves in research,
The word library has a couple of connotations that I don't think information naturally has. I mean, I think information in a way is almost like a Rorschach concept, you know, where you can kind of read anything into it. But the library does have a couple of clear things. One is the notion of an institution, okay? And moreover, it's an institution that in some sense is supposed to be representing, at least ideally, the totality of knowledge. And that's where the idea of classification and things like this become very important. That comes from the library culture, okay? Information science, especially with the introduction of computer technology, kind of absorbs all that stuff. But information by itself doesn't necessarily have those connotations. And that's one of the things that, in a way, makes information professional a much easier term to use in our neoliberal times. Because in a sense, you could talk about information professionals just a service provider. You need information of a certain kind, I can get it to you, right? There's no presupposition of a sense of an institution or of a sense of a need to kind of normatively organize knowledge in some kind of fashion. Information is agnostic on those points, okay? And so while information is a broader term, it's also a term that kind of has less kind of commitment to specific value issues.
Okay.
Yeah.
Currently, because of economic situations, I guess there's some significant cutbacks on education, and as such, a lot of the institutions now rely on donations from major companies, from large companies. For example, in the University of Toronto, the engineering faculty literally got kind of bought out or received a huge donation from Rogers. Rogers, in which case now is like the Ted Rogers School of Engineering.
Uh-huh.
So how do you propose that I can think that academia remain pure in terms of their research other than to cater specifically to these corporations?
Well, look, I think part of it, I think, you know, I believe we live in the real world too, so it's not like I'm talking about some other universe here. I don't think it's really a question of somehow moving to the ivory tower. It's not the issue. The issue is kind of having a sense of appropriate contractual arrangements, you might say. In other words, knowing what is in your interest to be pursuing here and having the other party, let's say this, you know, millionaire or whatever, respect that as part of the transaction. Okay? So in other words, you cannot just, I mean, I think one of the things, because this is true in all sorts of academic disciplines, right, where we're so much encouraged to get external money that people will basically tailor their research programs just so that the money is attractive, okay? The money will take the research. But I think what you have to insist is that actually there is a kind of, beyond just doing, providing service, and I have nothing against providing service, there is also intellectual needs that need to be made. So it's almost as if, you know, if you're putting forward a grant proposal, that there be a certain amount of whatever we might call overhead or something for the development of the intellectual side of the discipline, to enable enough time for research to be done that is of this of the discipline's kind. In other words, not just service providing, and that should be part of what is guaranteed, as it were, in any kind of fair contract. And this, I would say, should be true for any academic discipline that deals with an external client, is that there has to be some provision for time and resources for the pure academic work so the discipline's intellectual capital base can develop. Okay? Because I think one of the problems is a field like this could very quickly run on empty, as it were, just providing services for people and not necessarily improving the intellectual base of the field.
I really like the issue kind of attention being generalizing and
yeah.
Specializing. I wonder what you would say, just to tell them whether or not
well, two points. First of all, I do think it is of some value for people going into this field. I think if people go into this field at the master's level, not the undergraduate, that at the undergraduate level you have studied an academic discipline. But you know, just so you know what an academic discipline is kind of like and how it organizes its knowledge, you know. So I think that's a really important kind of, but which discipline it is doesn't matter. But it should be some discipline. In other words, I wouldn't want someone walking off the street trying to do this, right? There should be some kind of academic, substantial academic, like a major in subject, okay? The other thing I would say with regard to how do you know if you know enough to be able to actually do this global universal thing is, in a sense, that's a test of the classification system you're working with, you might say, right? Because if you cannot, if the way in which you're organizing the knowledge for your own use doesn't enable you to readily tell whether you're really getting to the bottom of something, then that's a problem with your conceptual framework. Because the goal of the conceptual framework should be ideally to enable you to get to the important bits as efficiently as possible, perhaps even more efficiently than a specialist who's inclined to ignore much more. Okay, so that's how I would parse this issue, but I don't think it's really an issue of you need to have studied X number of years in the specific field to get the relevant depth we're talking about. Because in a sense we're talking about depth, but we're also talking about breadth, right? Breadth isn't it? The undiscovered public knowledge thing is about specialists being so narrow they ignore most of their own field. And the question is, how do you access that?
Yeah, and I think that's maybe a problem with changing those into the specialist section, because a lot of, you know, the critiques that I talk to people who don't use the library, they say, like, well, you know, if I go to the library, they're just going to type in keywords that I already know, and they're not aware of the, like, you know, really hot topics and hot debates that are going on in my field. So if it's more a question of these experts being narrow-minded, I guess.
Well, yes, and I do think, you know, there's a sense in which you, one of the things you, I mean, a small thing, for example, you know, if somebody comes to you from a specific field wanting to know something about a specific topic, you shouldn't assume that the answer to the question is going to lie in their field, right? And so the kinds of searches that you do should range much more broadly than they would advise you to if they were controlling your search, okay? So there's a sense in which you should teach them something they don't already know about their own field. I mean, you should be in a position to do that. And that's where you establish your own authority as a knowledge producer, okay? Otherwise, you're just a service provider, okay? And so this means that, you know, I am setting you guys up for a certain amount of conflict and tension, potentially, okay? But I think that's the only way in which you can really begin to assert your autonomy as an academic discipline that has its own intellectual base that's separate from the specialists.
We have time for one more question before we let Steve go for this.
Yes.
When you're talking about why aren't there incentive structures for us to go out there and look for things we're looking for that we know we want to find, what, do you have any ideas on how we begin to, like I always have, like, I always come back to Good Will Hunting, where since you could have had the same education for just a couple of cents in the library. Like, you could know all the stuff by just reading, but how do you know, like, how do you know all the stuff that you should know and that you shouldn't know?
Well, no, that's tough. I think there's this, look, my understanding is, you validated this just before we started, that people go into this field because they actually like books and documents and probably are pretty widely read, you know, and maybe even indiscriminately read. And I think in this kind of issue we're talking about, that's a virtue, right? Because there's a sense in which in certain areas, you may in fact have quite a different take from the specialist, which you could then put forward as a kind of counter expertise to them. So I'm not saying you could challenge experts in terms of what they're not reading in every field, regardless of your interest in it, but I would have thought that all of you are coming from some kind of interest, right, where you've read very widely and so forth, and you could actually show the value of the knowledge that the experts aren't normally talking about. But see, this is the kind of thing that I would say should be the subject of theses and publications in this field. Right, so in other words, this becomes part of the knowledge base of this field that others can refer to provide some kind of basis, okay? And that's why I say it's a little unfortunate there hasn't been much follow-up to the initiative that Swanson made in the 1980s. But I do recommend you look at his pieces, because he does have very clear ways of doing this kind of thing. And he's not a specialist in biomedical sciences, a physicist, right? But he reads very widely, and you just look at his articles and you get a sense of how it could be done.
Kind of follow up to these questions. We just talked before you came, Steve, about kind of Hadorn and the long tail
of science, which is kind of a related idea to that.
And Hadorn does talk about the importance of curating that kind of dark data.
That's right.
And how you can make it more visible if you do that. I just want to be provocative, but you know what? We were talking about Google earlier because we love kind of talking about Google, and we said that Google did better at searching, information search with their box. They did come before us to the Google Book, the digitization project. What would prevent a Google type of, you know, organization to use data mining techniques and to basically just mine that long tail of science data? And then, is it just a technological issue? I want to believe that we might have like an intellectual and kind of more conceptual foundation to make a difference, but convince me otherwise.
Well, I think the issue here, this is where knowing the history of academic disciplines is important, because the narrowing of academic disciplines isn't something that just happens spontaneously. So you want to see the extent to which, you know, the mainstream practitioners have in fact just focused on certain areas and ignored other things, because one of the things you can be able to tell, which I don't think Google could tell very easily, is why this stuff's being marginalized. Things are often being marginalized for very specific reasons having to do with the politics of particular disciplines. And I think, you know, in social sciences it's very obvious, but it's also true in all the other disciplines as well. And so there you need to have some sense of history, of conceptualization, to get a sense of the nature of the exclusion, right? And so, and then you can start to see, okay, what kinds of issues might they not be talking about at a higher level conceptual framework? But what I don't deny, I guess what I don't deny in the question is, it is possible that you could turn this into a business. I mean, I think you could turn this into a business, right? That you could have a business devoted to undiscovered public knowledge in certain kinds of domains, and that you could create a market for it, and it would enable more of the knowledge that's already out there to be more readily available. So there, I do think that potentially there is money in it, but you have to come up with examples that really demonstrate this vividly, where because the experts have ignored certain body of knowledge, they ended up reinventing the wheel or not doing something as well as they could have had they known the literature better. And that's at the end of the day the trump card, right? The library information science people will say, had you known the literature better? We know the literature better. You see, and that I think is where you're coming from. But I think some of those search things would be useful and they could be turned into businesses.
Do you think the notion of the public interest would be kind of a defining factor, or do we need to keep holding on to the public interest?
Well, I do think so. Look, I must admit, even though we live in neoliberal times, people are worried about how every dollar is being spent. Well, it is a little strange that we spend all this money producing all this knowledge, only relatively little of which is ever utilized. And the way we monitor, we just let the experts trust each other in terms of what knowledge is worth pursuing. So you end up getting a lot of stuff, an oversubscription to certain areas, and other areas being totally ignored. So in other words, we produce this knowledge, but we don't really know it. We don't really spend enough time trying to understand it well enough. Okay, and that's just crazy from an economic standpoint, let alone every other sort of standpoint. And so insofar as the public is financing this, we should get the maximum use out of all the knowledge we're producing. And that is certainly not happening. Whatever else is happening, that is not happening. And you guys are in the best position to see this point. Because the experts don't have a vested interest in seeing it. Okay? I think it's a pretty clear point if you want to really push it.
Very inspiring interview. Join me in thanking Professor.